broadcasting from the UNMC College of Nursing. Get ready for RN Huddle, the podcast dedicated to bringing hot topics for and by nurses to the table.
Thank you for joining us on a podcast. I'm very fortunate to have my guest this time, Anne-Marie Nee, as an expert in pressure injuries in children. Now, some of you may think, in fact, I'm going to ask her in just a few minutes, children, what? Most of you probably think that pressure injuries are a condition in demented, elderly, tube-fed, incontinent people in a nursing home, and she's going to change our mind. So if you've been listening to the podcast, you know that I start with what's in my mailbox. So maybe you'll find this interesting, and I'll be really curious to see Anne-Marie's take on this question. I've been getting a bunch of email about stage two pressure injuries. And how do they heal? Do they heal with granulation tissue? What's the base of the wound? Are they always red and shiny? Can they reach the reticular dermis? And if they reach the reticular dermis, what do they look like? And there's just a whole slug of questions on stage two. In fact, there's so many questions on stage two that I think maybe NPIP needs to go back and do a little more legwork on that stage. So if you're one of the people that wrote to me about stage twos, you probably saw my answer that, the dermis has two levels. And if the injury reaches the lower level, it doesn't look like the upper level. I have to tell you, the check is in the mail. We'll work on this and we'll get back to you, but I appreciate your diligence and kind of holding our feet to the fire on this one. This one's a big one, and it's going to take us a little while. We're going to need some biopsies and some other things. So if you happen to have photos of unusual stage twos, we will take them from you. So let's get on with the program. This topic is pediatric pressure injury. And I think I have one of the world's experts in that topic. So let me turn to her and get a nice introduction, and then we'll get on to the material. So Anne-Marie, please introduce yourself to the ladies and gentlemen in the listening audience.
Oh, my God. Thank you, Joyce, so much for having me. And what an honor it is actually to be here. So I started my lovely journey at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, and I'm now at my third pediatric hospital. I'm at Dayton Children's Hospital, and I'm just so grateful for my entire journey. Hospital in between was actually Minnesota. And within the three pediatric hospitals, I think I truly have been blessed to see just how, not only how different hospitals function and the role of just related to nursing care, but also within pressure injury prevention. Each one has a little bit of a different take on it, on what they focus on, how they put together skin teams, how they want a prevalence day. And so that's actually given me, in my opinion, a very wider view than someone who has their entire career in one hospital, because you only know one way. And so it actually has allowed me to assist other hospitals across the country who have asked me for assistance to help tailor things to their structure within their hospital itself.
So let me go to that first statement I made. I know that you've heard that. I know that people have said to you, you must not have a lot of work to do if you're doing pressure injury prevention in kids because they don't have pressure injuries. Tell me what you say to those, well, I'd call them non-believers, or those people who actually can't believe that kids get pressure injuries. So what's your elevator speech? How do you deal with that?
I actually say children do get pressure injuries. Most of them are thinking of the big holes that they see in the elderly over the buttocks, and is not typically what we see in pediatrics. The number one cause of pressure injuries in pediatrics is medical devices. 83% out of my dissertation were all from medical devices. And for those who don't know, I did complete my PhD last year, and my dissertation was on looking at those risk factors for pressure injury development across all ages of pediatric patients. My youngest was 22-week gestation, and I stopped at age 21. So it's a very wide group, and the risk factors are not the same within each age group.
So the children getting pressure injuries, if they're from medical devices, then you're predominantly seeing them on the face, or where are you seeing them?
The number one location is the face, because respiratory devices are the number one cause of pressure injuries in children.
Wow. So how much deformity from the device actually stays with the child when they leave the hospital and they have, I'm making an assumption here, so correct me if I'm wrong. They have nasal oxygen or an endotracheal tube or a tracheostomy. They leave, does that heal up and they look normal after that, or are they deformed after that?
They're actually deformed. If we're talking about the NICU setting, I did have the great honor of working with a neonatal nurse practitioner at Children's Minnesota. Her name is Deanna Johnson. And Deanna was the first one who, because she was predominantly within the NICU, that we started really looking at what was happening. And the babies, when they are born, when they're premature, it used to be they wanted to intubate them right away. What the pulmonologists found out is actually they do better if they can get them extubated quickly and put them on bubble CPAP. And that bubble CPAP mask currently only comes in two sizes. And you have a wide variety of babies, and two sizes doesn't work. And so sometimes the larger size is too big, so they go to the smaller size. And what it does is it presses down on the tip of their developing type of their nose, the cartilage there, and that creates a bulbous looking nose, which had not originally been what have been the shape of their nose. So they are deformed and they develop in that direction. And there's not really much you can do about it because the cartilage is so pliable that it actually changes the shape of their body.
Oh, I find that sad. We certainly deal with medical device injury in the adult population, but I don't know that we see it as a deformity that requires plastic surgery, I presume, to recorrect the face and the deformity. That's tough to listen to because you're saving that child's life and you don't want to add insult onto injury. That's tough. How do you deal with the parents when they know or see the deformity that's formed from the device that was used to save the child's life?
So in my experience, you usually have one or two types of a parent. You got the one who is so grateful for everything because their child is still living and they have their child with them. And then their gratefulness just shows up in everything that they do. And so they're like, hey, my child is living. If they're slightly going to have a different shaped nose, or if a medical device created a scar tissue somewhere else, it's a stage three or four pressure injury. They're like, I'm just grateful they're alive. It's going to heal. I'm not worried about it. You get the other set of parents that said, excuse you, they wouldn't have had this if you had not done something, and you should have taken the precautions. And in those, it usually takes a gentle hand to try to walk with them, because it's usually not the fact that they're going to have a scar for life that they're concerned about or that's really causing their frustration. There's usually something else. And if you take the time in that room and actually sit with them and talk with them, usually you can avoid a lawsuit. However, if you can't, that's the end result for that type of a parent. They will sue.
Yeah, patients sue, parents sue, families sue for pressure injuries fairly commonly. Well, I want to go back and pick up what you said in the beginning, and that's the risk factors. We pretty much know the Braden scale, and we know that there's a Braden Q for kids. But as far as I remember, and it's been a while since I did a Braden Q in kids, the only thing that was added, well, no, I'm wrong. They added vascular and perfusion, right, and oxygenation in the Braden Q.
Tissue
And that,
perfusion and oxygenation, yes, as a risk factor.
correct. Then the one I'm thinking of is the device came in later on. But tell me, I shouldn't be answering my own question. I should be asking you, what are the risk factors? How are they different than in the adult population?
So the interesting thing, I think, for me, having been in this arena now for almost 30 years, you've seen so much, and I started questioning, why are we doing some of these things? The biggest one that came to me is when they always talk about moisture is moisture barrier. And that I've got nursing staff that truly believe that the moisture barrier over an infant is going to prevent a pressure injury in the sacrococcyx region. Babies don't get pressure injuries in the sacrococcyx region unless there's something else. What I mean is that in my entire career, I've seen one over the coccyx of an 8-month-old who had a tumor that in their abdomen that was removed and they had ascites. So you had a lot of pressure going that way. Without it, they don't get pressure injuries in that location. So my dissertation was actually 799 pediatric patients, and I did a logistic regression looking at 13 different risk factors. I used the risk factors that are in the 2019 International Guidelines for Pressure Injury Prevention and Treatment, and there were currently only two at that time articles that was out that looked at risk factors with a regression model. And I pulled out those. So it had like skin status and OR time and respiratory, different types of respiratory devices. And when I looked at my database, I also had patients that were on ECMO, so critical illness. And so I added that in to look at 19 different risk factors. And I did do regression models. The first publication is actually coming out in September and advances. That's where I have tentatively. So you can see this all in a nice graph. But over the total sample, what risk factors came out very clearly was patients who are on ECMO, decreased tissue perfusion and oxygenation, and malnutrition. And that was it.
So those risk factors are kind of not there in the adult world. I don't think ECMO right. shows up in the adult world of risk factors using Braden, that is, you know,
right.
because Braden's risk factor scales came out of rehab. So there'd be no one in rehab on ECMO. But you were saying earlier, mm-hmm. your pediatric patients don't develop pressure injuries on the sacrum or coccyx.
No.
Where do they get them?
They're the ones the medical devices mostly are related to their face or IV hubs. So the interesting thing in the infants, so tissue perfusion and oxygenation just for the infants was one with generalized edema. And we do see that, especially in the NICU setting with everything going on with these micropremies, they get a whole lot of very edematous. And so then we add multiple devices on top of them. And especially respiratory devices, we do a lot of interaction with our respiratory therapists because the nurses want to cinch them very tight because there's an air leak. You are allowed some air leak and they still are perfused appropriately, but that's part of a lot of education related to that and how to prevent that, but allow the babies to continue to perfuse. But it's edema within that age group.
Oh, that's fascinating because edema would not cross my mind, again, in the adult population, except with medical devices, because uh-huh. in the adult population, we put all the devices in and then we fill them with liter upon liter of fluid. And now the straps that were used or the tape that was used is so tight yeah. that it causes injury from the device. So what about the head? I mean, I think about when I did burn care. You know, I always looked at the percent of body size. And in the kids, I always had to adjust the body surface area. The head's pretty large, in at least the normal sized baby. I don't know that that's still true in the preemie. Does the head have any additional risk in those kids?
The head does, the back of the occiput, but it didn't come out very clearly within my research because at this particular time within history, we have devices, so many different type that are actually have been geared towards the back of the head if they're going to be immobile. I still see it at times. If you're using a pillow is absolutely not a pressure injury prevention device. I've seen many pressure injuries to the back of the occipital ridge if they're on a pillow. So that is an area that we do work is that occipital ridge because the way their head is shaped, it's much more prominent. They don't sit on the back of their head like we do as adults. They rest lower. And so you have to be very cautious of that area. So fluidized positioners help tremendously. And now even the different beds in the ICU, the giraffe beds, different type of incubator beds, they have much better surfaces that they're lying on than they used to.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, because I know when I used to make rounds in pediatrics, there was a lot of complaining about how poor the mattresses were mm-hmm. for pressure injury prevention. So the fluidized positioner's been a game changer in the adult world for pressure injury prevention. Sounds like you think it's a game changer in the pediatric world also, because you can make it fit the patient, which is what we like in the adult world, I presume true for you also.
When I was at Cincinnati Children's, we were actually the first hospital, pediatric hospital in the country to institute it throughout our entire facility. And so I think that we were actually, I don't know if we were the first in all hospitals, because it was in 2008, but we were definitely the first pediatric one. And we went from there. Made such a huge difference.
That's excellent. So what else did you find in your dissertation that the audience needs to know?
So I actually looked at that malnutrition. If you look through everything within the pediatric world related to risk factors of pressure injury, and I'm not talking about validity or reliability of a risk assessment score, a research looking at risk factors. This is the first time that malnutrition has actually come out as a substantial risk factor, which that just thrilled me. I also took the time to look at medical devices versus immobility in that same database. And the risk factors that came out for medical devices were conditions within the OR, decreased hemoglobin, skin constantly moist, which is not what we saw previous, excessively dry skin, and again, malnutrition. So what I surmise is happening, and I did look at the humidity within the isolates in the NICU, and that did not come out statistically significant, is that the moisture gets trapped underneath the medical device, which then decreased the tensile strength with the increased pressure on top of it. So that was statistically significant for medical devices. The only risk factor that came out statistically significant for immobility was decreased sensory perception. I thought that was very unique. Not immobility itself.
Wow.
Just decreased sensory perception.
Those are amazing findings. I think when that paper hits publication, it's going to be very important for not just the pediatric hospitals, because they've probably stumbled on some of this themselves, but there are pediatric wards in almost every hospital who don't have people like you to guide them to care for those children. So that's amazing work. Before we sign off, though, I want you to tell the audience about the anatomical difference in skin in the very young child, because this information was so new to me. I never knew this about how little there is of skin in the neonate, and it just sets the stage for how easy it is to injure their skin. So if you could end our discussion with that. Ladies and gentlemen, I find this simply fascinating because my world, like many of you, is in the adult world where we've got plenty of skin. We've got tons of skin and lots of injury can happen, and we're fairly quick to heal it. Anne Marie's story is going to be very different. So please tell the group what you've told me many times about the layers of skin and the number of cells that are there.
So I got the privilege at Children's Minnesota. One of the things that is part of their record at that hospital is if a child dies while in their care, they are allowed, or they get consent from the parents, and they take tissue biopsy. So we knew that that tissue was there, and we were able to work with a pathologist, Deanna Johnson, and myself. And her name is Robin Reed, who is currently at Seattle Children's. And she looked at the tissue layers for us. Now, mine and Deanna's purpose of looking at it was related to staging, but we needed Robin to say, what is there and what isn't there? Can we even accurately stage this? And it was fascinating to me because those who work in the NICU setting, physically watching these babies, they always say there is something about 28 weeks to 30 weeks gestation. What we found out is that is actually when the stratum corneum itself gets more fully matured. Prior to that, although there are levels of the stratum corneum, they're just not as developed. So 25 weeks on down, they have very little. The dermis layer is by microns. So we're talking like 400 microns. The epidermal layer is only about two to three cells. And that, as it goes up there, the subcutaneous tissue is completely scattered throughout the area. So they don't even have very good formed fat layer like you see in the beautiful full-term chubby babies. It is not there. They come out and are born, they look very ruddy. And it doesn't matter what is their natural skin tone that eventually develops. They are all ruddy color because that stratum corneum is not there and is not developed yet. And as we go along up to 35 weeks, we have about 4 epidermal cells, a little bit more subcutaneous tissue, and now our dermal layer, that microns, are up to about 900. And so it just continues during that development. When you look at it, most of the researchers will talk about transepidermal water loss to say whether or not you've got a good barrier or not a good barrier, but there is actually more to that. It's not just about the barrier function, because a full-term infant has a full barrier function, but that keratinized tissue is not fully weaved together yet. And so it actually has open, it's almost like an open cell weave, which allows for that the water lost to go out, but it also absorbs at the same time. That was one thing I learned with my dissertation. So they absorb it very quickly and then just as quickly release it. And so that's also how water gets trapped in these micro premature infants. So I just found the whole thing fascinating.
Well, I also find the whole thing fascinating because it is not my area of practice at all. I certainly want to thank my guest today, Dr. Anne Marie Nee.
Thank you.
For joining us today and talking about predominantly the different risk factors in pediatrics. I think the most startling news that you're going to take away from this is the significant harm that comes to these children from medical devices and the diligence that has to be provided by the nursing staff and the respiratory staff in caring for these children. Anatomically, we can't change anatomy and physiology of those children, but we have to respect the fact that you combine that lack of mature skin, three cells of epidermis, and they are applying respiratory devices to those children to save their lives. Look at the diligence that those nurses, respiratory therapists, physicians are doing every day with those children. So it's a miracle that they survive and thrive and are part of our population right now. Thank you, Anne Marie, for all the work you've done in your 30 plus year career. Thank you for being a part of NPIAP. We have all benefited from Anne Marie, as you can well imagine. She reminds us whenever we talk about pressure injuries that they occur in children. And she does it very eloquently and very frequently, and it's been good for every one of us to hear. I want to thank Courtney Smith, the coordinator of these podcast episodes. They will launch on what's called the RN Huddle, part of the University of Nebraska College of Nursing website. And they're also, of course, posted on the NPIAP website for your listening. Thank you for those of you that are followers of the program. And I'll catch you next time on our next podcast. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to RN Huddle. To stay connected, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at UNMCCNE. Or check out unmc.edu/CNE for more program information.